great sleep, low stress, really managing calories, macros, movement, training. That will take you a long, 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 long way. And for men, more than likely into the 10% body fat. For women, certainly down into sort of the 14, 15. And you would look and feel absolutely amazing.
Meet your host, Andy Naylor. Andy is a men's physique transformation expert, competitive physical champion, and a multi six-figure business owner who has helped thousands of busy, high-achieving men get into the best shape of their lives and reconnect with their inner alpha. On this show, Andy is going to share with you his playbook on feeling healthy again, avoiding the common pitfalls successful men fall into, dropping 20 to 30 pounds of fat, and building a physique you can finally be proud of. And the transformations aren't just physical either. You're going to learn how meeting your personal goals will help support your professional achievements, giving you that true alpha mentality. Let's go.
Welcome back to the show, Alphas. My name is Andy Naylor. I am CEO and founder here at Naylor Body Design and host of your Optimal Alpha podcast. And we are back with another live Q&A. And what I mean by live Q&A is what happens is my team collect and collate a number of already answered questions that have appeared in our clients' check-ins. So these are real questions that have been asked by our clients in our program that our coaches have solved. But what happens is they now collect them and give me a collection of those to go through. And I do not get to read them. So all I know at this point is I've got 10 to 15 questions. Sometimes I've got context, sometimes I don't. So I've absolutely no idea what I'm about to walk into. So these episodes are always quite interesting. So without further ado, okay, so this is the first time I've seen these questions. There are 15. So I'm going to go rattling through this as quick as I can. And really what's going to happen is you get, some questions I won't be able to answer, some I can, some will be more in depth, some will be very quick answers. Who knows? Question number one, when is the best time to take a fat burner? So the first thing I consider in my mind is what do we consider a fat burner? That is probably a topic for a podcast all on its own. What I will say is this, most of the time these things are just over-the-counter, utter rubbish. But there are things out there, there are compounds out there that absolutely do help with the stages of fat oxidization and fat burning. Not going to go into what those are here, but there are things out there that absolutely certainly do work. When is the best time to take them? Depends on a number of things. So one, how serious you are in getting super lean. Because the reality here is getting really damn lean is possible with no additional fat burning compound based help. Great sleep, low stress, really managing calories, macros, movement, training. That will take you a long, 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 long way. And for men, more than likely into the 10% body fat. For women, certainly down into sort of the 14, 15. And you would look and feel absolutely amazing. Generally speaking, fat burners are, people use them for, I would say, one or two reasons. One, because they are looking to get shredded. And when I say shredded, I mean shredded. I don't just mean, oh, got a set of abs. I mean, you look like a alien shredded, right? Stage ready shredded. That's going to require, for the most part, obviously not always, but for many people, some degree of assistance to get down there. The other group of people are people that are trying to cover over problems, cracks, and issues with the rest of their protocols, their sleep, their stress, their training, their food. They're trying to band-aid over those or problems that could be there with additional help to push them over the edge because they just maybe keep messing things up at the weekend or they don't get enough movement in, etc. So when is the best time to take one or a fat burner? There isn't a best time. I would suggest that you can probably get, I don't know who this is by the way, but I would suggest that a person can get a lot further down the fat loss road by just being a lot better at the basics. Number two, if I feel sore from my previous workout, should I still go to the gym? Depends how sore. I guess it depends on how recent you started training. Whoever this is. And again, I want to preface these answers with, I don't know who the client is. Okay. So I don't have the context of the client when I'm answering these questions. So what I think here is, so if you've trained legs, and you're due to train legs again and they're still super sore, probably best you don't train them. When you are training a muscle really hard, it's technically being broken down. You're causing a degree of damage to a muscle so that when the muscle repairs, it repairs maybe slightly bigger, maybe slightly stronger. That's basically it. That's it in a nutshell. So if your body is still going through the repairing process and you smash the hell out of it again, you're just digging a much deeper hole into your recoverable abilities. Okay? And you're also putting yourself at a bigger risk of injury. And so I know this right now. So I've got my vastus lateralis, in other words, the outside of my leg, the outside of my right leg, that quad, is extremely sore. And I've noticed this get more sore through the last two leg sessions where I press with a particular machine that really seems to target that muscle. So last week, it was sore to the point where I wasn't really sure if I was going to press or not, and I still did. The week before, I just kind of noticed it. So it got slightly worse 2 weeks on the trot to then this most recent week, it had been sore through the week, as in I would get out of bed, put my foot on the floor, stand up, it still feels kind of weirdly sore, and it's in a very specific place. That tells me if I go off and leg press at the way that I leg press, so the intensity and the control that I try to put into it, chances are this next time, it won't come away sore, I'll come away with a pulled muscle, something that then really has an impact and takes a lot longer to recover. So it depends on the degree of soreness. If you've got sore legs, could you go and train your upper body? Yeah, probably. Say if you've done a bicep and tricep workout and your arms and maybe elbows are super sore, could you go and do a full out back workout? Maybe, maybe not. So it depends on the level of soreness. It depends on how competent you might be in being able to kind of train around soreness, because that's possible. And what I mean by that is it could be auto-regulating what the next session is and what movements you're doing. So I still trained legs last week. I just didn't press. I didn't do the thing that I knew was going to cause direct issues. So I did hamstrings, hyperextensions. I was able to do leg extensions. I was able to do calves and adductors. So I still did a full out leg session with a very, very sore vastus lateralis, but I just didn't do anything that specifically targeted that. So it's definitely possible. Number three, how long does it take for a muscle to... Oh, this is interesting. Okay. How long does it take for a muscle to fully recover from an injury? What are the factors that influence a full recovery? So it depends what, of course, right here. So it depends what the injury is. And also age is a factor here. So I'm 45. I train pretty well, I would hope. My life is very much revolves around training and of course, all those things, as you can imagine. But I can tell you that with age, niggles hang around a lot longer. So I've had a left hamstring niggle that is probably about a year old now. It doesn't stop me from doing anything, but it's still there and I still know about it. And this quad little sort of niggle that I've got has now been there for a fortnight. Okay. So of course I get it massaged. I have a massage gun as well. So I do a lot of proactive work to try and bring that problem down. But these things, they do just hang around longer. And that's just, I guess, part of life. If you've got, say, just a niggle, chances are it'll go away quite quickly. If you've got a pulled muscle, they hang around a bit longer. If you've tore something, that's going to be a lot longer. If it's muscle damage or ligament and connective tissue, if you've got connective tissue damage, tendons, ligaments, they're going to hang around a hell of a lot longer than a muscular damage. Why? Well, a muscle has way more blood flow. Okay, so it's got way more ability to get oxygen in, nutrients in for it to be able to recover. And it's more elastic. The sheer way a muscle works lends itself to being able to recover. Whereas something like a ligament, particularly if you've hurt a ligament, that's going to hurt for a very long time and probably take a long time to recover. So it depends on the severity of the injury and how long it takes to recover. What are the factors that influence recovery? Well, the degree of the injury, first of all. A lot of your lifestyle, I would say. So, well, first of all, whether you continue to train on the injury. What a lot of people do, now here's what a lot of younger people do, and I certainly fell into this category, which is we would get injured and illness would come under this, but we'd get injured and just think, okay, I'll just train through it. And when you're in your 20s, you can do that. You can train through stuff and just seem to bounce back. It's kind of like if you drop a young, like a toddler's bounce. If you ever see a toddler fall over, like sometimes you can see a toddler like fall over and you're like, oh, that would break the bones of an older person. And they just bounce and get back up and carry on, right? Like so as we age, we clearly don't recover in quite the same way as, you know, we're not quite as flexible, bendy, robust sometimes. So it depends on if you continue to train on the injury. I think simple things, hydration status, sleep. Sleep and stress being extremely high here because they will affect your overall recoverable ability. And if you've got a lifestyle that's under stress, pressure, hectic, like how is your body's fighting those things and not really being able to focus on, you know, simply recovery from an injury. So doing the things that you probably know that you ought to, then you can be more proactive with an injury. So of course there are things like, so massage guns, hot and cold therapy. If it's connective tissue, things like BPC-157, which is a peptide that you can use, which I've used myself, and it definitely works. It definitely works with those niggles that I would say seem to be more connective tissue. So that's BPC-157. I'm not recommending you take it. I have personally taken it. I know a lot of people that do, and it really does work well. You can be proactive in bringing yourself back from an injury. But in the first place, it's injury prevention, isn't it? So better form, better recovery between sessions. That's where I would focus. Number four, I'm going on holiday next week and I want to keep on track with my food and training. What would be your recommendation? So I would say here, understandably, everybody treats things like holidays slightly differently. If someone is here and they want to stay on track, then really it's planning. So you're not going to take your own food on holiday, although I would recommend taking things like protein shakes and maybe protein bars, protein-based snacky snacks that would just maybe get you out of a problem if you're, you know, you're on holiday and you're going on a bus trip out somewhere and suddenly there's no food and you're, you know, it's either get off the food at the fast food station and eat some shit or reach into the bag, make yourself a protein shake and down. Like, do you know what I mean? So there's definitely things that you could take with you. Near enough any time I've gone on holiday, I take protein powder, I take some sort of protein bars. I generally also take AG1 or some sort of greens powder just to try and make sure I'm getting nutrients in where I might not be getting as many vegetables in. So I take the things that I think I'm going to miss out on. And then it's a case of the way I would look at things are just choose your food choices wisely. One thing I would also say that helps on holiday is probably intermittent fasting, because the chances are most people overeat towards the back end of the day, which is normal. So maybe push all of your food later in the day, which means if you're regularly having four meals a day back at home, maybe you're now only having three, which means you're nearly guaranteeing that you'll continue to be in a caloric deficit. Maybe, or even at maintenance, if that's the goal. So I think planning ahead. I think also continuing to track your food as best you can in something like MyFitnessPal and aiming to track the food. I know you might need to eyeball food. I know people that do take scales with them. If you're really serious, you'll take scales with you. I couldn't give a tiny rat's ass what other people think while I get my scales out, put my food on it. If I was in that mode, like if I was prepping for a show, my scales would be in my bag wherever I go. I couldn't care what someone else thinks. I used to go into Nando's, which is a sort of chicken-based restaurant in the UK, because I'd have one, up to a certain point out from the show, I'd have one meal off plan. Well, I say off plan, it'd be chicken and rice, but it'd be from a, it'd be at a restaurant, but I would still weigh out the rice and the chicken in the restaurant. And I couldn't care less. I don't care what people think. Not bothered. I had a goal to hit. And I ended up winning the show. So like when you make these commitments to yourself, quite often they pay off. So planning ahead for sure, making sure that maybe intermittent fasting further than the day. I would, of course, keeping things like steps in place, keeping things like hydration in place and taking some foods with you to fill in the gaps would be useful. Number five, what is your all-time favorite motivational quote? Okay, two come to mind. Whether they're motivational quotes, I don't know. One is the first tattoo. So if you're watching this on YouTube, this tattoo here, which is Latin, which is the first tattoo I had, says in a roundabout way, I'll either find a way or I will make one. That's stuck by me. I had this tattooed on my arm when I left working for other people. So I left working for, at the time it was, I was working in marketing and sales, managing marketing and sales teams for a daily newspaper. And I'd worked my way up as far as I possibly could. And then I'd started a business with my wife and we were going to go into business together. So I was, for the first time in my life, leaving employment and going to run a business, like completely be self-sufficient. And so I tattooed this mantra on my arm, which is, I'll either find a way or I'll make one. In other words, I'm just going to keep moving forwards no matter what. And that stuck with me because without going into it on this podcast, we ended up having to close that business. Joe and I, my wife, put ourselves into 50 grand worth of personal debt, and we had to spend 6 years of our life clawing ourselves monthly back out of that. And it was insanely painful. But it was either find a way or make one. That's one. The other one is always do what you've always done. You'll always get what you've always got. Right. So in other words, if you don't change things, and it's also if nothing changes, nothing changes. So I guess my motivational quotes are all about self-empowerment. That's a bit deep, Andy, but self-empowerment, because ultimately it doesn't matter because motivation to me isn't a thing. Motivation to me is just adrenaline and dopamine, and it comes and goes. I don't really think of motivation. I got up this morning. I was waking up this morning from 3 a.m. kind of excited to get into the gym. I went to bed early, granted. I was in bed by 7:30, which is a bit weird for me. And I was waking up early because I was like, I know I was going to get up. I was going to go down into the gym here in the apartment. I was going to record some content and have an arm session and start my day. And that just excites me. Yes, maybe that's weird, but it's not motivation. It's the discipline that I know what I wanted and needed to do when I got up this morning. And it's the moment I'm kind of ready, I'm up to go and do it. So motivation to me isn't really a thing. But yeah, there's my two quotes. Number six, I almost lost my shit on Thursday night. Think I'm going to have to swap out or complement steps for bike riding. What is the equivalent of 20 minutes of bike riding in terms of steps? Oh, in brackets, client bought a walking pad to get her 10K steps and achieve them 5 out of 7 days. So first of all, 5 out of 7 days isn't bad. It depends how bad the 2 days were. Yeah, it depends how close the 2 days were. But really, it doesn't sound that too bad. What is the equivalent of 20 minutes of bike riding in terms of steps? I would just swap 20 minutes for 20 minutes. I'd just keep it simple. I wouldn't try and work out, 20 minutes of steps burns this number of calories. Fuck it. I would just do 20 minutes to 20 minutes. When it comes to these things, and we get asked this a lot, and this is actually a question that comes up a lot, transferring of cardio to steps to things. I would generally not really overthink it. Although I do track steps and I make sure that no matter what I'm doing, I keep myself above 10K steps per day. But for example, some of those steps are on a Stairmaster and some of those steps are walking. Well, the steps on a Stairmaster and the steps walking are very different. Let's say 5,000 steps on a Stairmaster compared to 5,000 steps walking. The Stairmaster's way more difficult, takes longer probably, and is more difficult. But I don't care. I keep things simple. So first of all, whoever this is, if you've hit 5 out of 7, that's pretty good. And if the days that maybe you couldn't get out to do the steps, work out how many steps you were short by in time and just do that amount on the bike. Don't overthink it. Because if you're still making progress, you're making progress. Number seven, I don't have a check-in again. I had tummy indigestion problems that flare up sometimes. I think it's combined with a tummy bug this time. I'm upset I haven't gone to the gym and not been able to eat to plan. This is all disappointing and I feel bad with this check-in for you and for me, but I cannot change it. So just need to move on again. In brackets, it says client skip check-in due to tummy issues. Okay, so I have one simple thing here to say. Never skip a check-in. Regardless of how shit it is. When I was coaching people, if someone missed a check, Andy, I've not checked in because I've not had a good week. I'm like, I couldn't care less how good or bad your week was. Go and check in because it is the reinforcement of a positive habit. I don't care if the content of the check-in is crap. It's the reinforcing of the positive habit of checking in. It's the same as, let's imagine you're regularly tracking your food on MyFitnessPal and you have a really bad Saturday and you just don't track anything and you say to your coach or whoever, yourself, I'm not tracking my food on this Saturday because it was rubbish. What? So what? Just because so you only track the good stuff? Do you only want to see the good stuff? No. See the fucking reality. See reality. See it for what it is. Always be real to yourself. So no matter how good or bad a check-in is, you do it anyway. This is for everybody. You do it anyway. No matter how good or bad a day's food is, you track it anyway. No matter how good or bad you feel, you do your training anyway. This is discipline. This is the difference between discipline, commitment, and motivation. If something goes bad, motivation falls down, then the habits disappear, and then bye-bye progress anyway. Alphas, I interrupt this show with a simple message. This show is here to benefit you and your progression to the best version of yourself. But not only just you, it's also here to benefit the people around you, your loved ones, your friends, other alphas in your vicinity. So why not do a really cool thing today? Something that I would thank you for and maybe someone else would. Share this podcast with at least one other alpha out there who you know would benefit from it. Why not share the information, share the ability for someone else to grow? I'm sure they would thank you. I 100% would absolutely thank you. This podcast only grows by our listeners, our followers doing amazing things like giving us 5-star reviews, downloading podcasts, subscribing, and then of course sharing it with other people. I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Share it with one person, and of course drop us a 5-star review, download the podcast, and of course subscribe. And now back to the show. Number 8, how do I change my macros now that I'm going to reduce the strength training and increase my runs to get ready for a marathon? In brackets, marathon in September, cardio sessions will be max 30-40 minutes until July, but with a steady volume increase after that, 50 minutes plus. Don't really know that macros would need to change, particularly is the first thing that comes to mind. But what I can't see what the current macros are. This is going to be one that I can't answer because I don't know if someone's in a surplus, maintenance or deficit. And I don't know where the current macros are. For them, yeah, I'm not going to be able to answer this one because I don't have enough context to really help. But for the most part, if someone's reducing strength training, and let's say they were also in a deficit looking to lose body fat, right? So we'd still be strength training, right? Because we want to maintain muscle. There's a fair chance that whatever the macros were, potentially, whatever the macros were, that, you know, that's absolutely fine to continue. The only other consideration might be here more timing. So it could be that we load more of the carbohydrates in the week around the probably what would be the escalating runs to get ready for a marathon. Because my understanding of marathon training is there'll probably be 2 shorter runs and 1 longer run that's escalating all the way up to marathon. Now that longer run, most people's on a weekend. So I would probably, in terms of carbohydrates over the week, I would load more around that longer session. Okay. So maybe the couple of, like building up the couple of days before to fuel the session. And then obviously a shed load afterwards to, you know, to get the glycogen back into the muscle ready to go back into the week. That's probably the best answer I can give on that. Number 9. When I work out really hard, it impacts my sleep. I wake up sore in bed, which is worth, believe me. But what can I do to minimize this? Okay, so we certainly don't want sleep being impacted from training. First of all, well done on training really hard. Most people don't. Most people are not training hard at all. Most people think they're training hard, but not. And that's not a criticism. It's just that we only know how intense training is as we are able to become more intense and push up the level of that training. Most people are on the journey upwards. And then wherever you get to in terms of what you believe to be a 10, well, there's always something slightly above that. You can always be slightly more intense. I train pretty intense right now, but I know that I have trained more intense in the past. I train slightly under where I know my outright utter potential of intensity is. Why? Because it would impact the rest of my day. And really the rest of my day is what's important to me is energy through the day to be able to run my company. So there's no point training myself into a pit and then not be able to run the company. So, but anyway, first of all, well done on training hard. The fact that it affects sleep. So one, I guess the first thing I consider is where are you training in the day? Because if you're training just before you go to bed, maybe you need to be training in the morning. So you've got all day to start recovering. So the timing of the training is the first thing. Maybe then also, is it possible to reduce the volume? So you can still train at super high intensity, but then actually reduce the volume of the training so you get less soreness. That's another thing. Hydration status, maybe adding some calories in, maybe a bit more carbohydrates might be useful. Maybe things like electrolytes to make sure that you are super hydrated. Those would be the main things. They're the main movers that I would imagine. So maybe changing volume. So I wouldn't change intensity because once you're used to training at a high intensity, unless this is really causing you a problem, you could then have a play between how high the intensity is and how much volume you're doing. However, if you want to continue training at this high intensity, which is awesome, I would say maybe reduce the overall volume. In other words, the amount of sets you're probably doing to a body part. Maybe bring in the training earlier in the day, if that's possible. Then you've got longer in the day to recover. maybe raising hydration, some more water, and maybe bumping up food a little bit. Hope that helps. Number 10, I have nausea every 3 to 4 weeks causing an autoimmune disease. It's so odd, I cannot seem to find any correlation. Green apple has been curbing the nausea, and protein shakes stay down, but really mostly liquid only staying down for the most part, unfortunately. I kept down almost nothing yesterday. What can I do? And then in brackets, it says, not clear yet the cause type. At the minute, I suggest to track and then create an emergency food plan with foods that she can keep down. So I would say, so first of all, this is the sort of question that requires way more context for me to sit and answer in a podcast. This is, of course, well, as soon as we start talking about autoimmune diseases, of which I don't know what it is, I don't know the history, this is certainly a question. This is a serious question, or all serious questions, but this is a particularly serious question that I think would also require medical history. And then we're starting to get into the realms of, for coaches, there are certain lines and gray areas where as we start to move into them, we're like, look, this is now requiring physician, doctors, consultants in specific areas like autoimmune disease, that as coaches, there's certainly not areas that we're, you know, qualified, I would say, to give good, clear professional advice on. And I'm always very clear on this. And I think this is a problem that coaches can get themselves into. And we certainly don't hear, because this is my ethics, that they want to have the answer to everything. There is far more I don't know than what I do know. Of course there is. So when I come up against a question like this, I do not know the answer. And I would not want to sort of stray into trying to answer this when I just don't know enough about it. So I'm going to have to pass on that one. Number 11, what is cutting and is it something I would ever do? If so, when? In brackets, client is currently in a caloric deficit and losing weight. You are cutting. Cutting is just a fitness word for dieting. I think really the term probably comes out of the sort of bodybuilding world, cutting and bulking. We would kind of put those two next. So cutting would mean dieting down, bulking would mean building up. So cutting is just technically being in the caloric deficit, that's it, and dropping body weight. That's simply all that cutting really technically means. It's a sort of snazzy word for just dieting or trying to drop body fat. Number 12, what protein bars would you recommend? Oh. First of all, probably making your own, which sounds like a real ball ache. And yeah, it kind of is. But I make what I would say is it's like a protein brownie. And so it would have, hang on, what's it got in it? So obviously it's got protein powder in it. It's got cacao powder. It's got a little bit of flour. It's got ground oats, egg, a lot of fat-free Greek yogurt, orange extract. Weirdly, a little bit of instant coffee. That's basically it. And I bake that as a brownie and eat it. And the only problem is it's already in one go, isn't it? So it's very difficult not to eat the whole thing. But I know exactly what the ingredients are and I know exactly what the calories are. And guess what? It really sits in my tummy very well. Outside of making something like that, what one would I buy? Well, the one I'd probably buy most would be Carb Killers. They're about 207 calories and like 1.1 or 1.9 net carbs. They taste pretty good. There's loads of bloody flavors. Generally speaking, that's the one that I would have most. 13, can you remind me what a deload is and what is the benefit from or of them? Okay, a deload, again, if someone's training hard enough. So most people don't really require a deload because they're not training hard enough to need the full sort of recovery that a deload brings. So if someone's training super hard, let me give you an example. The last time I was really training to build muscle, if I'm really honest, and I mean really training to build muscle, so I was in a caloric surplus and I was actually looking to build muscle because I was going to go off and compete in Classic. This would have been the back end of 2021, the beginning of 2022. And I was training hard. And the way that I was training, that was escalating volume. So each week I was doing more volume, but I was also training to failure on everything at some particular point. And it gets to a point where what you're looking for when you're really pushing that hard, your body just gets to a point where it just can't continue at that upwards pace. And so what happens is you'll suddenly get to a point where, well, one, desire to go to the gym is dropping, two, performance is dropping, and then suddenly a week you'll go in and like, man, everything feels so heavy this week. Like I'm, and my numbers have gone back. So this is where tracking numbers and, you know, how much weight, how many reps, sets, etc. And all of a sudden it's like, damn, I really didn't hit last week's numbers. And you've technically gone backwards. That's a sign that you've dug so far into your recoverable ability that you've just got to take a back step. So we take a thing called a deload. It's just deloading. So there are two ways, there's probably more, but there's two ways that I would go around this and that we've helped clients. One is stay out of the gym. You just take a whole week off the gym. However, the hour or hour and a half that you would have spent in the gym, you devote to recoverable works, i.e. you get a massage, you do hot and cold therapy, you go walk in nature, you read a book, you do something that is specifically designed to aid recovery. So you don't just waste that time. You just swap that time for, could be yoga, Pilates, stretching, something that would actively aid recovery. That's one. The other one is you still go to the gym, but you do 50% of the work with the same load. Okay. Now, the reason that this works quite well is the one where you take the full time out of the gym, which is still useful. Normally, when you go back, it takes a week and maybe a little bit to kind of get back up to full flight. Okay. Which is losing time. If you go into the gym and do the 50%, you use the same load, but you do half the sets, half the reps. So you're going to walk out the gym thinking to yourself, I could have done way more. And that's the point. So you've still maintained your CNS activation level at the loading that you were doing the week before. So wherever you've got to, but you've done so little volume, your body's still able to recover for the most part. So then after you've done your 7-day deload and you should be quite refreshed, you go in the week after and you're still used to moving the same load that you did 2 weeks ago. So now upping the volume back to start a cycle again makes a lot of sense. So those are the two things. And deloads, I got to a point where I could train about 5 weeks flat out and then the 6th week would be a deload. And the more times I went round it, the shorter it was getting. It got to a point where I think I was maybe training 4 weeks flat out and needing a deload because I was training so damn hard for me, so damn hard and making so much progress. My body just couldn't maintain that level of progress for any more than 4 weeks. The 5th week would then be a 50% deload and then I would start again. That's how they work. So question 14. Is this meal too much protein? 65 grams. Well, I don't know if you're male or female. I'm going to assume male, because for a female to get in 65 grams of protein, that doesn't happen a lot. For a man, you could certainly eat. I mean, you go out and have a really nice fillet steak and you're going to smash 65 grams of protein. No problem. Is it too much? It's on the higher end for sure. It depends on, let's say, here's some perspective. Let's say someone's intermittent fasting and this is one of only three meals at the back end of the day. Each one of those three meals would have to be very high in protein to hit the protein requirements for the day. So that's one thing that comes to my mind. Let's say someone's eating six meals a day. So this is now the exact opposite, right the way across the day. Each meal isn't going to be up at 65 grams. And I would say having something like, you would then be floating between the 30-40, because generally speaking, between 30 and 40 grams of protein per meal will be enough to elicit muscle protein synthesis, as long as there's enough leucine in there as well. So therefore, the additional protein is, I'm not going to say it's a waste, but it'd be better spread out. Protein is simply, if you need to eat 200 grams of protein a day, I would just divide that equally by the amount of meals you're having. That's it. It's that simple. So once you've worked out your protein requirements, which is generally speaking, a gram per pound of body weight, you then go, oh, well, I'm 240 pounds, I'm jacked. I need to eat 240 grams of protein. Cool. Now just divide that by three meals, four meals, five meals, six meals, whatever, and then just eat them through the day. Simple as that. So 65 grams is not too much. It's on the higher end for sure, but it's not too much. And last but not least, number 15, how can I reduce soreness from training? So we've kind of covered this, I guess. One, do you want to reduce soreness from training? Like, I love the day that I wake up and I'm like, oh, I can really feel whatever muscle because I smashed the living hell out of it 2 days ago. Like, I don't get that anymore. It's hard. Like, that's kind of disappeared and I miss that. So probably it depends. If you've got that sort of soreness that literally is debilitating and stops you walking up and down stairs, right. So what would you do? Well, it will go naturally. Because here I am, you know, 20 something years into training and I don't get sore. Like, I kind of wish I did. I do ache, like stuff aches and is kind of sore, but not that real true DOM sensation, which I miss. So if you're relatively new back into training, this per level of soreness will naturally dissipate over time, because your body's just going to get used to what you're asking it to do. As long as stress, sleep, hydration, food, etc., are all in place, it will disappear. If you're not new to training and you've been training a long time, and you know we've suddenly given you a training system that's making you really sore, again, that is a novel stimulus that over time will dissipate, and you will the soreness will disappear. If you're like, no, I just cannot go about my day-to-day life this sore, then drop back on how either hard you're training or the volume. Okay, in one way or another, that could be just doing a set of less of something. Or if you've been training to absolute, like everything shaking type failure, just don't go to failure. Just kind of go to like 1 to 2 reps close to failure. Okay, just don't go all the way to absolute muscular mechanical failure. Away from that, consider what's your stress levels like? What's your sleep like? Where's your hydration? And are you getting in enough calories? And a mixture of all of those things are going to help you reduce soreness. So there we go, my guys. 15 questions, real life. So I hope you found that interesting. And we will be back to another one of these in maybe a month's time. For today, over and out.
Thanks so much for listening to today's show. We hope that you feel motivated to start making changes in your life so you can see those results that you've been wanting to achieve. Remember, you can do anything you set your mind to. If you love the show, please leave us a 5-star review and make sure you tell your friends. If you'd like to connect with Andy, you can find him on Instagram at Andy_Naylor_Pure_Elite_Pro. I'll leave a link in the show notes as well. Talk to you again soon.